we come from that long-term hold perspective. And so the point of the game is to stay in the game, to have good, high-quality assets that are safe, that continue to produce, that get to that infinite rate of return period as quickly as possible, and then operate them very, very well for decades to come.
Welcome to Surgeon Syndicate. If you're paying attention, you know that you only make money when you work. It might be great money, but it's dependent on you. The information on this podcast will help you solve that. We interview experts and provide analysis into financial freedom through commercial real estate. Why? To help physicians like you thrive. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Surgeon Syndicate. This is your host, Dr. Michael McManus, and we are here today with Dr. Elaine Stogeberg. Elaine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Oh, you are welcome. Elaine is a psychiatrist, a mother of four, and owner of Black Swan Real Estate. She owns and manages a portfolio of over $300 million in assets under management. Through real estate investing, she reached financial freedom in her 30s and now helps others do the same. Black Swan has delivered exceptional returns to hundreds of passive investors through their unique investor-focused private equity fund, which enjoy no sponsor fees whatsoever, 100% return of capital to investors before any splits, and long-term returns and tax advantages, all coupled with a socially conscious investing and at least 5% of profits donated to charity. You can connect with her at meetblackswan.com. Elaine, I've read your thing at a conference. I saw your whole thing last summer in Charlotte, and we never were able to meet because you know how sometimes conferences go. But thank you for being on the show. It seems like now I know lots of people who know you and I've heard great things. So tell me more about your investment strategy. It looks like you've worked really hard to kind of de-risk the process for your investors.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of starting from the beginning, that really helps you to understand why we structured our private equity fund the way we did as we grew. So way back in the beginning, when Nick and I started doing real estate investing, I was in medical school. He was the only one with an income. Our combined household income was less than $100,000. And so we knew we wanted to invest in real estate, but we knew we also did not necessarily have the financial wherewithal to just keep earning down payments over and over and over. So we had to ask ourselves, how do we take this bucket of money that we've saved up, buy a property, renovate that property, keep that property, pull the cash out, and then do it again? This was before like BRRRR was popular from Bigger Pockets, like before that word existed. But we had this idea that if we buy something that needed a lot of attention, and then we did a lot of the work ourselves, that we could increase the value enough that then we could put a mortgage on that property, pull out our capital, and do it again. And that's exactly what we did. I remember so well that very first day when we finished that cash out refi, we were sitting in the car, we had a paper check, and it was more than the original value of the home. It was all of our down payment, all of the money we had put into renovations and some additional capital. And Nick and I said to ourselves, we will do whatever it takes to have this moment as many times as possible. And so then we continued to grow our real estate portfolio over about a decade. I'm sure we'll get into how the portfolio grew. When we moved to the private equity fund model, and we really wanted to scale this thing and make it available to as many passive investors as possible, we kept that same model. So we've never sold a single asset. We're big believers in buying properties, doing physical renovations, management improvements, increasing the value enough that we're able to do a cash out refi, and then keeping all of those golden geese so that you can continue to benefit from the cash flow, the debt pay down, the opportunity for forced appreciation, the opportunity for market appreciation, all of the tax advantages, and just grow your wealth and all of your income streams, despite the fact that there's just one bucket of money in the beginning and you just reuse it over and over and over through a cash out refi strategy. And then we've done other things in our private equity fund that is just very intuitive to us, certainly not market norms, but just feels like it was the right thing to do, where we don't have any GP level fees whatsoever. So we don't have an asset management fee, capital event fee, loan recourse fee. There's all sorts of fees that are available to GPs and we choose not to charge those. And then 100% of all of our profits go back to our partners until they're completely repaid, so that every penny that they get back, exactly like you described, they're de-risked in the deal. Then they have all of their capital back, but then they stay in the deal indefinitely for that indefinite hold period. We plan on targeting about a 20 to 25 year hold period. And so they're in that infinite rate of return period with us, and we're all growing our wealth and cash flow together.
That's awesome. So for a lot of multifamily folks, when the interest rate environment changed, you've seen a lot of the chaos that has gone on. And I'm sure it's affected your new deals, but as far as existing deals, because your timeline is so long, has it had any effect on your ongoing deals with the change in interest rates?
Yeah, it's a really astute question. So as with many things at Black Swan Real Estate, we do things very differently than market norms. So from a debt perspective, all of our debt is with local regional banks, people that we know personally, we have lunch with them, we know their families, big believers in having relationships with our banks. So we don't have any institutional debt, Wall Street debt, debt from debt funds. All of our debt is fixed rate debt. Much of our debt is 5-year terms with another 5-year reprice. So it's technically a 10-year term with a 5-year reprice. Not all of our debt is that way, but years ago in say 2018, 2019, 2020, we knew that interest rates wouldn't stay low forever. So we wanted to lock that in as much as possible. So we got at minimum 5-year terms on all of our debt. And then where we could negotiate it, we got 10-year terms with a 5-year reprice with a maximum of a 2% escalation. So we can model out what our mortgage payments will be for the next many years in a way that folks who have variable rate debt didn't have that security. So that's a little bit separate than the question that you asked, but I want to just throw that out there that the debt is half of the deal, right? So the deal is the deal itself and then the debt. And that's the magic of real estate investing. And for many years, debt was so plentiful and so easy to get that I think people got kind of sucked into riskier and riskier debt options. And then 2021, 2022, 2023, really 2023, when the Fed raised the rates came, and a lot of pain hit the market as those variable rate products escalated in cost so much. What we've seen in the projects that we have is, number one, we're doing huge deep value add projects. And so even as the market value is shifting, we have so much margin from the value that we're forcing that we're still net ahead on all of our projects. The other thing is we have no sale. So even if the value of any individual property went down, we wouldn't lock in that loss by selling. We plan to hold for decades to come. And then what we've been able to do in order to accomplish a cash out refi over the last, say, 18 months as rates have gone up is instead of doing like a true cash out refi where you completely pay off the first mortgage and put a whole brand new mortgage on, we've gone to the banks and we've said, hey, you've known all along that our business plan is a value add cash out refi plan. We still want to do that despite the fact that rates have gone up so drastically. There's no way we want to get rid of our 3.5% mortgage. So can we put a second mortgage on that property? And that one's at that new higher rate, say 6.5. I think the highest that we have in the entire portfolio is 6.75. But the blended rate combined is still quite low because we're keeping that original mortgage, putting a second on. That's available to us because we work with local regional banks where we have relationships and they understand that, yes, it's a second, but if they have the first lien, then that second lien is still quite strong. And we're able to do that with our relationships.
That is incredible because that is a relationship thing. I'm thinking about pitching that to a banker that I've just met versus the insight when it's somebody you've worked with from years and they know your business, they know how you're set up, they know your stability, and it changes their risk. And they're also absolutely banks that have an appetite for what you do.
Yep. Yep, exactly. So we're always in relationship with our bankers, having lunch with them, walking them through projects, taking them on tours of buildings that their bank doesn't even have the debt, but just to show them what our construction product looks like, how our team is in motion, having them meet our property managers, really getting them to understand exactly like you described, who we are, what our risk profile is, why we're a good bet. And it's important to keep in mind that bankers need incomes as well. So as interest rates have gone up over the last 18 months, they still want to sell loans because they're typically commission-based and that's how they make income. They just want to sell good, safe loans. And so positioning ourselves as the good, safe option, hey, you already have the first mortgage on this property. Let's pop in a second. Here's why it's good for us because we've increased the value so much. Here's why it's good for the bank because you have capital that you need to place into the community. Might as well place it into this good, safe building with this good, safe operator.
That's great. When you talk about there are people too who need an income, and sometimes that really gets lost. And as real estate operators had to adjust to changing markets, so did bankers.
That's right.
You know, a lot of them, some of the banks were like, hey, run these short duration, super low rates and churn, 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 churn. And then one day their boss comes in and goes, stop lending. What? Yep. And if you understand their pain points and can help them, it's almost like you come along and they're like, oh, thank goodness, we got a nice safe loan here because the boss wants safe loans.
Yep. That's certainly the energy we want them to feel.
I just want to go back to when you talked about when rates were at 3% and you're like, this isn't going to be this way forever. I love hearing that because there were so many people that as rates went up and they're talking about, oh, we'll be back to 3% in 12 months and 20 months or whatever timeline. And looking back, I still don't believe it's sustainable to be at 3%. It does crazy things to asset values and it doesn't provide enough reward on the lender side. And it doesn't make sense to me in a lot of ways. So to hear somebody who looked at that 3% and said, how can we lock in as much of this 3% as we can get, but we're not going to do like a variable rate 3 year to get 2.7.
Exactly. Exactly. Like that potential short-term benefit, in our opinion, was not worth the security. And I think that's because we come from that long-term hold perspective. And so for us, the point of the game is to stay in the game, not necessarily to win each little section of the game in the moment, but to have good, high quality assets that are safe, that continue to produce, that get to that infinite rate of return period as quickly as possible, and then operate them very, very well for decades to come. We've never sold a single asset. And so we had that benefit as we were doing new debt to say, well, what kind of debt would we have wanted on the portfolio 10 years ago? Aren't we so glad we have fixed rate debt on that portion of the portfolio? It's important to remember interest rates went up some in 2017, 2018. And then they came back down. So we had invested through an interest rate rise period before. It was much more muted compared to what happened in 2023. But that was enough of a taste to say, hey, rates don't just stay this low forever. They go up and they go down. And looking at real estate data over a period of decades, right? If our intended hold period is decades, then we need to look back decades and say, well, what has the behavior been like in the 70s, the 60s, as much data as we can possibly get? Well, you can look at those interest rate graphs and see that the rate doesn't just stay at the bottom forever. Sometimes it goes up very, very, very far, right? Like in the 80s, and having modeling of like, well, what would we do if interest rates went that high? Because we intend to hold for decades. So maybe that will happen in the decades that we're holding as well. And I think it just gives us a very different mindset than what is typically found in private equity, where the hold period was 18 months, 2 years, maybe 36 months. It's just a very different mindset.
It's nice to hear that too. And from the standpoint of anybody who's an investor, I mean, I look back and maybe because it's grilled into my mind that my parents bought their first house in the mid 70s, their mortgage rate was 17%. And when I bought my first house in the late 90s, I was at 8.5%. And I got to refi a year later at like 7.5%. And walked away thinking I had the most screaming deal ever. And then the first place I bought after medical school was like 4.5%. And I thought I had just found the deal of the century that we would never, ever, ever see interest rates that low again. And so you don't know. But when you start looking at 3 to 5% as being normal, I don't know. I think it's like a sucker's trap that it's going to always be this good. So I commend you for looking at that really big picture. And I guess if you never plan on selling, you're not looking at a time window of being in and out. So it changes that perspective some. It's interesting because I have an associate who I have some money in some of his deals that he's on kind of the total of the other end. It does a lot of land entitlement where really he looks at it as a 9 to 18 month period of changing the value, doing the value add, but doing it a little different, and then moving it along. But at the same time, he talks about the same thing. He likes the short term, like there's fewer variables that can come into the picture. So he can evaluate the deal, make the deal work, and get out of that deal, and then move on and look at the next deal and reevaluate the whole picture. But even he talks about a lot can change in 18 months. And what happens if things go sideways? What are we going to do with this? And even he doesn't like sub 5 year debt on projects that he plans on getting out of within a year and a half. So it's such an interesting topic.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you figure that the average real estate market cycle is 7 to 8 years, right? And the cycle that we just went through in the post 2008 crash was by far the longest cycle ever in real estate history. The average cycle is 7 to 8 years. Ideally, you would want your debt to be at least 7 to 8 years so that you can get through a whole cycle. And I want to be clear here that I'm not saying time the market, but you should also be evaluating your debt about every quarter and saying, is this a good opportunity to refinance this debt? Has the value of the building changed? What's the interest rate out there? What's the lending environment? Is there a bank that's hungry for this business? Be thinking about that about every quarter or so. If you have a whole real estate cycle to work with, then it's much more likely that you will have a period where values are high and rates are low than if you only have, say, 1, 2, or 3 year debt. If the average real estate cycle is 7 to 8 years, 1, 2, 3 year debt could get you in the bottom part of the cycle and you have no room to work with. So that's why as much as we could, we got our debt for 10 years. Banks don't really like 10 year terms. So that's why they have a 5 year reprice. But at least we know what the reprice is, that it's a maximum of 2%.
We'll get back to our show in a minute. But first, I want to offer you an opportunity to accelerate your learning. My life changed and my ability to start becoming work optional changed when I gained the people and the knowledge to start investing in commercial real estate. One of the key people there was Ash Patel and joining his Invest Beyond Multifamily Mastermind. With that, I had the people and the knowledge. Well, that mastermind is no longer open, but for a fraction of the price, Ash has now made a course, and this is probably the most valuable set of information, the quickest way to move along your learning curve. So if you are interested in actively investing in commercial real estate and retail and industrial and office, I would recommend this course to you. We're going to include a pre-sale link both in the show notes. It'll also be on the surgeonsyndicate.com website. And in your checkout, we'll save you another 1%. I know it's not a lot, but every little bit helps if you use the discount code MIKE1487. So take that step now and move your future forward. If you're not interested in investing actively, give us a call here at Fortress Capital. And let's talk about what your goals are as a passive investor. But it's time to stop listening, start acting, and let's move your future forward. That's awesome. So you guys are in Rochester area, Southeast Minnesota. And this is fun for me because being in Green Bay, it's once in a while when you have somebody on the show that you're talking about our same little Midwest corner of the world here. Mm-hmm. Have you seen big changes in the market in that area there?
So Rochester, Minnesota is home of the Mayo Clinic, which is consistently rated the best hospital in the country, the best hospital in the world, the largest employer here. Rochester has consistently won awards going back into like the early 90s as the best small town in America, the best place to raise a family, the best schools, those sorts of things. So just a really solid Midwest culture coupled with what I perceive to be one of the greatest businesses in all of the globe. And it's a tourist town, right? So there's that aspect as well. It's a medical tourism town. Rochester is still a place where there's cash flow, and there's also an opportunity for significant forced appreciation and then also market appreciation. So it's not an extremely expensive market, say like on the coasts, where our business plan wouldn't really work because when cap rates get so low, it becomes somewhat impossible to exercise a cash out refi. Rochester's kind of this like hybrid middle market. We're also in Tacoma, Washington, which has very similar market dynamics to Rochester. One of the reasons we really like Rochester is because of what's called the Destination Medical Center Initiative. You can research it at dmc.mn. It's a fascinating case study for anyone to look at. It's the largest ever public-private partnership in the state of Minnesota that's bringing together dollars from all sorts of different players. Most importantly, it's the largest per capita spend on infrastructure anywhere in the country, which is saying a lot for like a rather small town in the Midwest, because Mayo Clinic wants to be the destination medical center of the world. And in order to do that, it needs to expand the hospital, expand the number of employees so that it can serve more patients. And in order to do that, the city of Rochester needs to expand so that there's a larger population here, so that they have a larger pool for employees. And Nick and I had come of age in Oklahoma City. And Oklahoma City, many people may remember, had the bombing in the late 90s. And that really changed the culture of that city. And then there was what was called the MAPS project, which was a 1 cent tax that completely revitalized Oklahoma City, brought in the Thunder, redid the downtown, poured tons of money into the schools. And we had come of age seeing that town mature and really become a national destination, a big city, so to speak. And so Destination Medical Center feels very similar to MAPS. And so we said, hey, we've seen this cycle once before in a different city that sort of grew up, so to speak. I bet there's going to be a lot of opportunity here. And that's what we've seen, that as the population is growing, there's more opportunity, values are going up, rents go up, there's opportunity to build because there's more people coming in. And then we always knew that Mayo would announce a very large expansion because they said so in the Destination Medical Center plan. I thought it might be more like 7 or 10 years away. They actually announced it in 2023. So it's a $5 billion expansion immediately adjacent to many of our parcels. So we acquired all this real estate because, again, we're long-term thinkers. We acquired all this real estate as close to the Mayo Clinic as humanly possible, thinking that, hey, sometime in the next 10 years, they've said they're going to expand their hospital operations. It will eventually happen. Turns out it happened much, much faster than we anticipated. So again, it's kind of getting back to that theme of having long-range thinking, having a safe, consistent plan with the major opportunity for upside that comes from Warren Buffett. And just thinking about, we know we want to be owners in this community, and how can we do so from the perspective of benefiting from the rise of this community overall?
That's so awesome. I think a lot of people, they look at buying real estate. I had this conversation with somebody recently about a town around here that they wanted to buy a place because they're like, oh, this place is going to boom and it's going to be amazing. And it's on that speculation versus investing side. But where you've come at it is you're buying properties that cash flow anyway. Mm-hmm. So they meet that investment criteria, but you're putting them in a place that most likely is going to see significant appreciation from that speculation side. Even if Mayo said, guess what, we're not going to expand, you're still okay. Mm-hmm. You've bought them and set it up that they still produce cash flow the way they're supposed to. But then when Mayo does expand, you've got the chance for this big event. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That comes straight from Warren Buffett, who says the best investment is one that has steady returns with the potential for massive upside.
I was also just amazed because you look at the politics of expansion. And one of the things I've heard over the years about Mayo is, well, you know, Mayo's in such a small town. Mayo is so remote, as if it was the negative thing compared to like the Cleveland Clinic, Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson, some of these other destination places. And the way they worked with the city, they turned it into their advantage mm-hmm. because it's harder to do in Houston or New York City or Cleveland. There's so many more players involved to try and do mm-hmm. a big partnership thing. Mm-hmm. And so they took what was, I think, perceived maybe as a disadvantage, made it an advantage. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Understanding Rochester is such an interesting study of understanding what it takes to make a city and to make a culture. And you're absolutely right that Rochester is somewhat remote. It's about an hour from Minneapolis-St. Paul. It does have its own international airport. Mayo owns the airport, so anyone can fly in any size jet. Private planes land in Rochester every single day. We used to live right by the airport, and we'd see all the private planes landing and wonder, you know, who's coming to town, who's getting care. But people can fly into Minneapolis or Rochester. And in terms of being that international destination medical center, a lot of people really prefer Rochester as opposed to some of those other bigger cities because it almost has a feel of like a college campus. There's very little traffic. There's no crime. It's easy to get around. There's basically this like Mayo bubble that like once you're here, you're kind of in the Mayo bubble, as opposed to imagine maybe you don't speak the language very well. You're ill, right? Or you're here with a family member who's ill and you go to a very large American city. That might be quite overwhelming. But you go to this rather small town in the Midwest, and basically the entire thing is the Mayo Clinic. And then because of that, Mayo controls so much. Like, for example, there are very few bars in Rochester. Whether or not that's good or bad is up for debate. But there's a certain very clean, wholesome medical vibe here that people really like. Very, very safe, very, very clean. They certainly have, exactly like you described, turned Rochester into their advantage to say, hey, if you come to Rochester, Minnesota, you're here and you are basically inside of the Mayo bubble and everything will be handled for you and the city will take great care of you. And it's easier than going to some of these other larger cities.
There's so many correlations when you were just talking about that of their little bubble. Before I went to medical school, I was working in the ski industry and I was in Aspen. And when you talk about the jets coming in from all over the world and the little bubble and how you feel there if you come from another culture, because when you're in Aspen, people are there for skiing and shopping in Aspen, but you can come from anywhere in the world and the whole place is built around making it a wonderful experience. Mm-hmm. And it's like Rochester's done that, but instead of skiing, it's healthcare. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like that same thing. You can fly directly in from anywhere, no matter how big your plane is. And when you get there, everybody understands why you're there and the whole community is kind of supportive of that whole role because everybody there kind of depends on it. I can't imagine there's nobody in Rochester who doesn't in some way make their living off of the mm-hmm. Mayo Clinic. Yep. Regardless of what you do, the people there and everything that's going on, if you pulled Mayo out of Rochester, everybody would feel that. There's mm-hmm. no...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I trained at Mayo. And so I have drank a lot of Mayo Kool-Aid, very happily drank a lot of Mayo Kool-Aid, just so honored to have been able to serve that institution and to train there and learn there, and not just medicine, but culture. So a lot of what I speak about having this long-term vision and this long-term hold, sure, that comes from things like Warren Buffett and other investment experts, but Mayo has a 100-year plan. And every question they ask themselves is, how can we serve this patient in front of us and advance the cause of medicine for the next 100 years? Well, that's just a different way of thinking. And you can see how you can take that exact same thing and put it into an investment portfolio. And Mayo says, every dollar that we have came from a sick person. Is this the best way to spend this person's dollar that they gave us to care for them? And just like the honor that comes from that, this like sacred obligation that this money came from somewhere and it means something to someone. How can we use it to make sure we're taking very good care of the people in front of us and advancing the cause of medicine 100 years from now? You can see that culture in our ethos, working with our investors, that our investors' capital came from somewhere. Many of our investors are physicians. I know exactly how hard they had to work, the years of sacrifice and delay and all of the things. And understanding that sacred obligation that as we're spending their capital, doing so in a way that advances their financial life right away, but then also advances their financial wealth over their lifespan, which is why we do such a long-term hold. And so many things of the way I think about the world and the way our whole city thinks about treating the people that come to our doorstep comes from that really excellent culture at Mayo. And it's just been such an interesting privilege to get to learn medicine there, but really learn culture and then take that and create a business that ultimately serves the institution, right? By creating all this housing in our community, we are in a roundabout way serving the institution. Such a blessing. It's like one of the greatest blessings of my lifetime. A little Mayo infomercial there, but once you've had the Mayo Kool-Aid, you just want to pass it out to other people.
Well, it's awesome how you shared that. I mean, you talked about Oklahoma City and how you saw the city did a very focused capital raise and growth initiative to build the city into something. And my little brother is in the military and is close by at Fort Sill. And so to hear his description of Oklahoma City from what he has seen versus what he had heard, because within where he's at, a lot of people had been in Oklahoma City a long time ago and tell different mm-hmm. stories than the current Oklahoma City. But you took that and saw what had happened and allowed you to kind of see how that fit with the vision at Mayo. And taking Mayo's 100-year vision, that's pretty incredible when you say, okay, how does this today in our culture doesn't work that way? Mm-hmm. And so it's really something very different. And that what you're doing is synergistic with Mayo, who is driving this long-term plan, is all pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So with that, I am going to wrap up this part of our show. Elaine, thank you for being here. And please join us back for our second half of our conversation with Elaine. And thank you for joining us today on The Search and Syndicate. Again, leave us a review, a like. We even like the bad reviews because it tells us what you dislike. But it also helps other people find us. So thank you for joining us here on Search and Syndicate. We'll get back to our show in a minute, but first I want to offer you an opportunity to accelerate your learning. My life changed and my ability to start becoming work optional changed when I gained the people and the knowledge to start investing in commercial real estate. One of the key people there
with Zosh Patel and joining his Invest Beyond Multifamily Mastermind. With that, I had the people and the knowledge. Well, that mastermind is no longer open, but for a fraction of the price, Osh has now made a course. And this is probably the most valuable set of information and quickest way to move along your learning curve. So if you are interested in actively investing in commercial real estate and retail and industrial and office, I would recommend this course to you. We're going to include a pre-sale link both in the show notes. It'll also be on the surgeonsyndicate.com website. And in your checkout, we'll save you another 1%. I know it's not a lot, but every little bit helps if you use the discount code MIKE1487. So take that step now and move your future forward. If you're not interested in investing actively, give us a call here at Fortress Capital. And let's talk about what your goals are as a passive investor. But it's time to stop listening, start acting, and let's move your future forward. This has been an episode of Surgeon Syndicate. If you found value in this episode, know other surgeons are hungry to become job optional. You can help them by sharing this content today. I also want to serve you better, so I want to offer you two things. Number one, I'll be able to give you the content in an even better way if you can take a moment and leave an honest review of the show explaining what you like and what you don't. Number two, if you are a surgeon and serious about this, you don't want to do this on your own because you don't want to make mistakes with your money. I'd be happy to help. Schedule a call and we can make a plan. I'm looking forward to having you with me on the next episode.